appeal number 07-1329, Cohen versus Estrue. Mr. Daly.
Good morning. May it please the court, Fred Daly for the plaintiff appellant Diane Cohen. Mrs. Cohen had filed for Social Security disability based upon impairments of multiple sclerosis and severe migraine headaches. She alleged disability in 1989, and she has a date last insured of December 31st, 1991. In denying her claim, the administrative law judge primarily did it based upon a credibility finding. On page 3 of his decision, he found that what detracted from her credibility was that it was noteworthy that her last job had ended in the 7th month of her pregnancy, that she was drawing unemployment benefits, and her reasons for subsequently not looking for other work included a desire to care for her infant daughter. None of those are reasons for discrediting one's credibility. She stopped working in her 7th month of pregnancy because she lost her job. She was let go. She collected unemployment benefits because she has a right to. And she did not allege she was disabled during that period. It wasn't until a couple of years later that she alleged disability when she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. She decided to stay home with her daughter for 2 years because she said she needed a lot of help. She was having, after the birth of her daughter, her headaches and her fatigue exacerbated. There was no way that she could have worked and taken care of her daughter, and she had a lot of help from her mother and her husband. However, she still didn't allege she was disabled after the birth of her daughter. She waited until 2 years later. The administrative law judge then also discredits her and finds she's not disabled because he says that the treatment records do not establish functional limitations that would preclude all work. The treatment records is basically the thrust of this ALJ's decision denying benefits. He claims that, he goes on, in fact, to cite to the records. The first ones he refers to are Exhibit 18F. Those records, in fact, the state agency doctors that found that Mrs. Cohen could do light work never even had these records. These came in afterwards. And these records, as the administrative law judge notes, indicate that she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, that she was feeling very tired, had decreased energy for 5 years, had ringing in her left ear, she was tripping over her tongue, and, you know, these are natural symptoms of multiple sclerosis. These symptoms help her case. They demonstrate she's disabled. They don't detract from it. He goes on to refer to her ophthalmology report that she had 20/20 vision. When you look at those records, the reason she saw the eye doctor was because she had blurry vision, seeing spots in her eyes, and she couldn't read a sentence without the words at the end of the sentence. She was losing sight of them. He doesn't mention that.
Those were symptoms the record reflects she was experiencing before 1991?
Yes. Those records were sent in to the administrative law judge after the hearing. They were obtained after the hearing.
Okay.
That was 18F, page 7, I believe. This is the eye doctor's records. He then mentions that Dr. Davis's treatment records begin on August 20th, 1992 through 2003. That's not true. He continued to use other records beginning from 1992, 93 up to 1999 from Dr. Davis, saying that supported that she wasn't disabled and she had the functioning to work. However, all of those records, we maintain, support her disability because she, throughout the records, always complained of severe fatigue and headaches. But nevertheless, what the judge was doing was he was taking records from 1992 through 1999 and saying you weren't disabled in 1989 and you weren't disabled through 1991 because of records from 1996. He never discussed the records from 1990 and 1991. We look at Dr. Davis's December 17, 1990 treatment note, page 144 in the record, and what we see is that she comes in saying, I'm okay now. That's what the ALJ and the government likes to say. She says, I'm okay, I'm doing good, doctor says stable. But she says, I'm okay, except for fatigue. She has occasional tingling and numbness in her legs. She has blurred spot in her vision. and she has headaches, and these headaches can be dull or throbbing. She goes on to tell the occupational therapist that she's having difficulty taking care of her child at home. She needs to rest. She then tells Dr. Davis on July 29th, 1991, starts off doing good. But then it says, although she's getting fewer headaches, she's getting them weekly. And she says, the pain is always in the right and the left, and it can throb. I have to sleep if it's a bad one. I'm always tired. What the administrative law judge also did that's rather peculiar in this decision is that he made a finding that she had severe impairment of multiple sclerosis and migraine headaches. In order to have a finding at step two, one must have clinically acceptable diagnostic techniques that verify the diagnosis. So he accepted this. But then, 2 pages later, in his decision on page 5, he says, regarding the claimant's complaints of migraine headaches, they were assessed as without features suggestive of medical or neurological disease. And then he apparently just dismisses him for that reason, and in his findings he doesn't include him as a severe impairment, despite having found him a severe impairment 2 pages earlier. But when we look at Dr. Moore's records, and Dr. Moore was the doctor that during the relevant time period the claimant was seeing for her her migraine headaches, what we see is that where the judge got that was from page 117 in the record, where Dr. Moore did mention that they were not have a neurological etiology. However, he did diagnose migraine headaches based on criteria for migraine without aura, and that was on page 120 in the record, and it was September 5th, 1991, within the date last insured. He found out that she had at least 5 attacks fulfilling parts B through D. So she has a diagnostic, she's met the diagnostic criteria of migraine headaches. It apparently was accepted by the ALJ, but he never applied that into her functioning and her residual functional capacity that he must do. He basically dismissed the report of Dr. Katsimaris and Dr. Freeman because he felt that they were not consistent with the treatment notes of Dr. Davis. That's untrue, as I just mentioned. And he also did not mention Dr. Freeman's opinion that the plaintiff met the listed impairments. And he contrary to the Rebuto case of the Seventh Circuit, which says that you cannot have just a perfunctory analysis of a listed impairment, the ALJ, the only basis he gave for finding there was not a listed impairment was he said Exhibit 8F by the state agency doctors indicated that she did not meet a listing. You look at 8F, there's no mention of listings. It's a residual functional capacity assessment. He had no contrary opinion on the listings in the record. Dr. Freeman's opinion is the only one we have. Thank you.
Mr. Sanchez?
May it please the Court, Alfred Sanchez, appearing on behalf of Michael J. Astrew, the Commissioner of Social Security. Good morning, Your Honors. Before I address a couple of the points made by counsel, I just kind of want to put this case in perspective as it was seen by the ALJ. This is a case of a woman who stopped working in 1987. She stopped working because she was laid off. One other person in her job had been laid off before her. She then received unemployment benefits, holding herself out as able to work. Thereafter, she gave birth to her daughter, and she did not seek further employment during that time because she wanted to stay at home and take care of her daughter. The period from the birth of her daughter through the date last insured of December 31, 1991, shows minimal treatment for her condition. Further, the clinical findings during this relevant time between June 1989 and December 1991 do not show any significant abnormalities. In fact, in July 1989, Dr. Goodkin examined Ms. Cohen and reported at the time that she appeared healthy. Her cranial nerves were intact, her vision was good, her upper extremities showed no evidence of drift or focal weakness, and her sensation in her upper extremities was normal. Dr. Goodkin also noted that Ms. Cohen's sensation in her lower extremities was normal, that her gait showed no impairment, and that heel-to-shin testing was normal. Also during this relevant period of time, Dr. Davis, who was Ms. Cohen's treating physician, noted in December 17, 1990, that Ms. Cohen was doing well, and she was doing okay despite fatigue. On July 29, 1991, Dr. Davis noted that Ms. Cohen remained stable. He noted that she was doing good. In August of 1991, the last visit before Ms. Cohen's insured status expired, Dr. Davis stated that Ms. Cohen was doing good. So this case is notable for the fact that all Ms. Cohen can do is build her case around two opinions that were rendered in 2005, almost 14 years after her date last insured. Neither physician saw Ms. Cohen or examined her during the relevant time period. And in fact, only one did examine her, and it wasn't until almost a decade after her insured status. Neither of these physicians based their opinions of disability on contemporaneous medical evidence during the relevant period. And while the ALJ considered these opinions, he reasonably declined to give them much weight. Now, Ms. Cohen makes much of the fact that the ALJ did not properly weigh these opinions. One of the opinions was from Dr. Katsimakis, and the ALJ discussed that opinion at length. The ALJ had a number of reasons for why he was reluctant to accept Dr. Katsimakis' opinion. First, as I noted, Dr. Katsimakis did not examine Ms. Cohen until almost a decade after her insured status expired. So he did not begin to obtain a perspective of her condition until well after her insured status expired in 2001. In addition, his conclusions about Ms. Cohen's disability began in 1989, conflicted with Dr. Davis's treatment notes during that relevant period. As I indicated, Dr. Davis on numerous occasions noted that Ms. Cohen was doing well, or he took note of the fact that Ms. Cohen was saying she was doing good. There's also the reality that treating physicians are sometimes placed in difficult positions where they're asked to render an opinion in support of their patient's claim for disability. And the ALJ acknowledged in this case that, yes, Dr. Katsimakis appeared to be doing everything he could for his patient. However, his conclusion of total disability of her disability began in 1989 may have been influenced by wanting to help her with her case. This court has previously observed that it's not unheard of that a treating physician may try to do a little bit more to help their client, their patient. Then it was entirely reasonable for the ALJ then to rely on the contemporaneous medical evidence that was more informative than relying on equivocal opinions rendered after her date last insured. And this is particularly true with respect to Dr. Katsimakis, as he himself noted that it was unknown to him whether there had been any increase in the patient's degree or weakness or decrease in tolerance to any repetitive activity that the patient was able to perform without difficulty in the past. And that's on page 148 of the transcript. In addition, Dr. Katsimakis stated, unfortunately, the unpredictable course of MS leads to fluctuations. These statements demonstrate that Dr. Katsimakis was basing his opinion on speculation rather than the relevant medical evidence during the relevant time period. Now, with respect to the other physician that counsel noted, Dr. Freeman, the ALJ also indicated that he was affording it minimal weight as to the claim's condition through her date last insured when compared against the treatment record and other evidence. What's remarkable about Dr. Freeman's opinion is that the only piece of time-relevant evidence that he looked at was an MRI done in 1989. And he didn't even have a copy of that MRI. He didn't even have a copy of the report of that MRI in 1989. What he was relying upon was a summary prepared in 2003 of a report of someone's interpretations of that MRI and comparing it to an MRI done in 2002. And it's from that report and his comparisons that Dr. Freeman is able to make this opinion of disability. And it seems a little bit illogical to believe that a doctor can review an MRI or a summary of a report of an MRI 14 years later and come to the conclusion that an individual meets the listing or that he can tell what their functional limitations were 14 years earlier. The Social Security listings require much more. They require documented, definitive, objective medical evidence that shows specific abnormalities. And Dr. Freeman's review of this MRI exam in 2003 is not sufficient. Rather, what Dr. Freeman relies upon is evidence that postdates Ms. Cohen's insured status. Dr. Freeman affirmatively acknowledged that his primary reliance was on Dr. Katsimakis' report prepared in 2003, again over a decade after Ms. Cohen's date last insured. And Dr. Freeman relied on this report to conclude that if the listing was met in early 2003 per treating physician examination, it is likely to have been met by the same findings and underlying pathology in 2001 and 1989. So Dr. Freeman can't even commit in 2005 that she meets a list in 2003, not to speak of 1989. Also, Dr. Katsimakis relies on this January or this April 2003 report prepared by Dr. Katsimakis, in which Dr. Katsimakis was asked whether Ms. Cohen experienced fatigue of individual muscles after sustained or repetitive activity. He was instructed to give examples of the exercises, and he was asked to identify the muscles involved and rate the severity on a 5-point scale. Dr. Katsimakis' reply, which was, I believe, on 148 of the transcript, he simply indicates 2/5, and that's woefully insufficient to either meet a listing or show that someone has functional limitations 14 years earlier. And I also want to note that when you look at Dr. Katsimakis' report on 148, it's interesting to note that all he has is 2 out of 5. It wasn't a physical examination report. In fact, on that report, he indicates that he last examined Ms. Cohen in January of 2003. And if you compare that physical examination report in January 2003 with the April 2003 report, you'll see that Dr. Katsimakis indicates that he didn't even perform a physical examination of Ms. Cohen in January 2003. So the ALJ was very reasonable to be reluctant to rely on these post-date last insured evidence when the contemporaneous medical evidence during the relevant period showed that she was not under a disability. And the ALJ could have gone into more detail as why he rejected Dr. Freeman's opinion, but it would have been another analysis of Dr. Katsimakis' opinion, because the reasons for why Dr. Freeman found him her disabled was based on Dr. Katsimakis'. As far as the ALJ's credibility, the ALJ looked at a number of factors in trying to determine whether or not this phone was credible. He looked at the objective medical evidence, which was very minimal during the relevant period. He looked at her treatment history. Ms. Cohen saw the last time she saw Dr. Davis prior to her expiration of her insured status. He noted that she was doing good. She only saw Dr. Davis once a year thereafter. He notes, the ALJ also looks at her activities, and he also looks at her work history report. So he had a number of factors before him that led him to believe that her testimony in 2004 about her condition in 1989. Between 1989 and 1991 wasn't fully credible. So the commissioner asked that you please affirm the ALJ's decision in this case. Thank you.
Bailey.
Both the commissioner and the ALJ refer mostly to medical records 10 years later and say they can't be related back. But there's no reference to the contemporaneous records. The ALJ never mentioned them. Counsel just mentioned that the ALJ gave reasons on her activities, on credibility. He didn't. Her activities were, for instance, in the government's brief on page 34, they have said that she also indicated her headaches were painful but allowed her to continue normal activities. Now, they're referring to Dr. Moore's report on page 118, and this is where she says she has some moderate headaches, and this was back in September of 1991. These records are contemporaneous with her date last insured. And what she actually said, she didn't say that she could have headaches and continue with normal activity. She said she rated some of her headaches as moderate, which are painful but able to continue normal activities. But she also rated an intensity rating of most severe headaches of being an 80, and she says she gets those in the late afternoon upon wakening different times a day. She said the headache frequency is five to six times a week. The intensity waxes and wanes in intensity. She has her headaches have acute and severe episodes, and she indicated that they can last 1 to 2 days, and she has to sleep when she has these severe headaches. So below in that report, she refers to the difficulty she has with her daily activities. So if you concentrate on the medical records that were contemporaneous, they do support finding a disability. Thank you.
Okay, this case also will be taken under advisement. We'll proceed to...